to order. Today is Thursday, March 3rd, 2022. The time is 8:03 a.m. We have with us this morning Representative Drummond, Representative McCabe, Representative Potkatak, Co-Chair Shragi, and myself, Representative Hannon. We have a quorum to conduct business. Today, our recording secretary is Lori Rowland. Talia Ames is our LIO moderator, and Stephanie Andrew is our committee A. On today's agenda, we will hear an introduction of House Bill 309 by Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins, entitled An Act Exempting Candidates for Municipal and Office and Municipal Office Holders in Municipalities with a population of 15,000 or less from financial or business interest reporting requirements relating to campaign finance reporting by certain groups and providing for an effective date. After that, we will hear House Bill 227 by Co-Chair Shragi, entitled An Act Relating to Municipal Energy and Resilience Improvement Assessment Programs and Providing for an Effective Date, and take up member amendments. And lastly, we will take public testimony on Senate Bill 143 from Senator Reback, titled An Act Relating to Horizontal Property Regimes and Common Interest Communities and Relating to Mortgages, Deeds of Trust, and Other Property Liens. And we're going to start with a motion to adopt a version of a version of the first bill that we're about to hear, of House Bill 309, because there were some changes from drafting. Representative Shragi, do you have a motion?
Yes, Co-Chair Hannon. I move that the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee adopt the blank committee substitute for HB 309, Work Order Number 32-LS0540-G, as a working document.
And if there's no objection, version G has been adopted.
Brief at ease.
Back on to invite Claire Gross, staff to Representative Christ Tompkins, to please introduce yourself for the record and walk us through the bill.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon, and good morning, members of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee. I am Claire Gross, staff to Representative Christ Tompkins, and I'm going to give a brief overview of this bill. This bill was seeking to remedy basically two things only that the Alaska Public Offices Commission had identified as time wasters, or basically things that could be streamlined to make them work better and make the whole process work for everybody. Despite being six pages long, like I said, there are only two substantive things in this bill. And the first one is that it provides a campaign disclosure reporting exemption for smaller groups who don't intend to raise or spend more than $2,500 in a calendar year, $5,000 during an 18-month election cycle. It also exempts these groups from electronic filing requirements for these reports. There was already an exemption for this electronic filing requirement for due to retention candidates and municipal candidates, and this is putting these groups in line with that. The second thing it does, and where most of the conforming language of this bill is referring to, is Section 5, which is where it exempts smaller communities, populations of 15,000 people or less, from public official financial disclosure or POFD reporting requirements. There's already a minimum population exemption for campaign disclosures, but none for POFD filing. So this was trying to bring that also in line. Yes. And then the rest of it is conforming language. So that's the sections that are substantive in this bill are it's section one, which is the exempting groups that do not intend to raise $2,500 or more from reporting requirements. And section two goes on to exempt those same groups from the electronic filing requirements. And then sections three and four are just conforming language for section five, which is the portion that adds the exemption for people that seek or hold municipal office in a municipality with a population of $15,000 or less, or 15,000 people or less from the POFD disclosure requirements of this section. And then sections six through nine from then on are conforming language for this section five about the population cap. And there is an effective date for the bill of January 1st, 2023.
Okay, and I will note we also have online for questions Heather Hebden, the Executive Director of the Alaska Public Office Commission, and Alpheus Bullard, the bill drafter from Alleged Legal. Representative McCabe, you had a question.
Thanks, Madam Chair, Co-Chair. I have a couple questions. How many municipalities in Anchorage have less than 15,000 population? Any idea? My guess is most.
Ms. Hebden, do you have any sense of how many local elections, municipalities that this would impact that have populations of less than 15,000?
Hebden, Executive Director for the Alaska Public Offices Commission. Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I don't have exact figures in front of me. My guess would be about 25 communities.
Okay. Follow up.
Thank you. And I guess my next question is, why did that matter? I mean, I did my financial disclosure online. I didn't need a municipal clerk. I didn't need to use the mail. I didn't really need to do anything. In fact, I think I did it in the airport on the way here. So I'm curious why this is necessary, I guess. We're trying to streamline, and I get that, and I'm not a big fan of financial disclosures, but I could be in my district and still move to a community of less than 15,000 and then not have to do a financial disclosure if I was running for the municipal election. Is that...
Representative McCabe, that is correct. If you are running for municipal office under this bill, you would no longer, in a community less than 15,000, you would no longer be required to fill out a POFD form. Really, the purpose behind this was the smaller communities that continually struggle with clerk turnover, connectivity issues, and mail service. What we find is that they are at a distinct disadvantage to those that are in the urban areas that don't struggle with these issues. These people in these smaller communities are oftentimes, they're not required to file electronically and oftentimes can't. So for these particular filers, the vast majority are still submitting paper forms. The vast majority of these people are also serving in a volunteer capacity, trying to serve their communities. And what we find is that we're continually penalizing them for many things that are beyond their control.
Thank you.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure who this question would be directed to, but how did the bill sponsor come up with a number of 15,000 or less? Because we here in the House serve in districts that have 17 or 18,000 people in them, and we have to file public official financial disclosures. I think, doesn't Wasilla have, 7 or 8,000 people in Wasilla proper and maybe Palmer? Ketchikan is pretty close to 15,000, I think. It seems to me that this is a kind of a strange number. If you're seeking to exempt small, remote communities, and none of those places that I mentioned are considered small in their larger context, or remote, or without robust internet.
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, we came to that number in talks with Heather Hefton, who helped us come up with that. So I would defer to her on that.
Ms. Hefton?
Representative Drummond, initially when we were exploring the concept of these changes, we looked at the minimum threshold that exists under campaign disclosure, and currently that threshold is in communities of 1,000 or more. The 15,000 number was not necessarily put forth by the agency because, as you noted, does capture many more communities that we weren't necessarily as concerned about. But the 15,000, to answer your question, is it exists in the statute already to identify communities that are required to file electronically. Anybody in a community at the municipal level in a community of less than 15,000 is not required to file their statement electronically. And I believe that's how that number was identified.
Follow up.
So that number 15,000 conforms with other limitations already in the statute for other reasons.
Through the chair, yes, it does.
Okay. Madam Chair, I think I would like a list of communities that have populations of 15,000 or less at some point. Thank you.
Other members' questions? And let me note that Representative McCarty has been with us for at least 5 minutes, and it's 8:15, but I did not write down the time, so we're going to call it 8:10.
Thank you.
If that's fair enough, or were you?
Fair enough. So, through the chair, if I can add on there to what constitutes a community, a region of the 15,000, or has that been addressed?
Ms. Hebden, did you hear that question?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question?
Can you address what is a community? What does that region look like? What are the boundaries that constitutes a community that 15,000 would be comprised of?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Okay, so the example there is, let's say, Healy. Is it the community of Healy off the road or the whole borough? You know, what is the region that is considered a community of 15,000?
I think Ms. Gross is going to attempt to answer that question.
Yes, through the chair, Representative McCarty. I'm just wondering if it's maybe a language mishearing. Maybe I said community, but it's municipality. And is there maybe a standard definition for that? It's municipalities with 15,000 people or less.
Okay. That answers that. Thank you.
Yes. Remember, these are municipal election, so there'd be their legal defined boundaries, and then I presume that it's the legal census data that they use for that. So there's probably a time lag of a few years with accuracy, but the boundaries don't move very often. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I only see like 4 or 5 municipalities of greater than 15,000. So this would, every municipality in Alaska other than Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks, Eagle River, even Wasilla's 9,000, Sitka's 8,000, Ketchikan's 8,000. Those are estimates of as of 2022. So I think I agree with Representative Drummond. I'd like a list, I think, before, especially if we can get one before amendments are due.
This is just our intro hearing.
Sure.
So we're going to send Ms. Gross and perhaps Ms. Hebden away with some homework.
Cool.
And so
Heaven the teacher.
Heaven the teacher. I think we're hearing that we need a little further explanation of who is impacted and the problem we're trying to fix. So adjusting the population to meet the problem of communities that don't have that struggle with electronic submission, but there's also some other exemptions, and I'm sensing we don't want to make it too broad, but we want to resolve a problem that was described by the sponsor's office as a time waster. So we want to make sure that we're capturing the problem, but not snowballing. I will also note that it said they could do them electronically. They don't have to, is the exemption that this is creating, one of the exemptions. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think it's going to take all that much work. The Alaska Municipal League has a directory of communities in Alaska. And here's the page on Wasilla. It has a population of 8,963. So Representative McCabe was just about spot on with 9,000. Type of government, that's a first-class city. So does this apply to a first-class city or only to those that are labeled municipalities?
So perhaps our second piece of homework is what are the elections that would be covered? Because, of course, we're now sort of straying into population and municipalities, but really this is about elections. So we're looking for that intersect of I guess one more. Does this incorporate REAA elections or not? Are they in a completely separate section of the statute? I assume that REAA election communities would be some of the smallest that would be impacted by connectivity. But I have never been inside of APOC. So, Ms. Hebden, you might see we're wanting to understand the problem, and you know, there's a few points in there that are catching our attention.
Through the Chair Hannon, thank you. And I'm happy to elaborate a little bit more on that. The REAA elections are not regulated by our office, so those would not be impacted through this. And I am looking at a list of communities right now. I mean, when you're talking about these municipalities and their population, one of the things to note is that municipalities are able to exempt themselves from POFD law, and a vast majority of these smaller communities have already done that, going back to 1975, I believe, and moving forward. So right now, under our POFD regulation, we oversee, I believe it's 30 communities right now, municipalities and boroughs. Of those 30, five of them are over 15,000. I paused there because I'm mixing up campaign disclosure. Five of those are over 15,000. So this would impact roughly 25 municipalities.
Perhaps you could provide the committee with the municipalities that are covered by it and ones who've already exempted themselves from the POFD disclosure law.
Yes, I'm happy to do that.
Representative Shragi.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. To take us down a little bit different path, I'd like to ask about the $2,500 number that's been selected in the bill. I'm just curious what the impetus for that was or motivation for that was. Do we have a lot of groups that raise less than $2,500 that get involved in elections? And I'm just kind of curious what the motivation was here. Thank you.
Through the Chair, Representative Strage, the $2,500, that particular number was identified through what currently exists in statute for municipal and judicial candidates who agreed to raise less than $5,000 during their campaign cycle, which spans a period of 18 months or 2 years. So this was an effort to try to make it equal for these smaller groups. I wouldn't say that there are a lot of smaller groups, but what we find are we get small groups that are interested in one election, one particular issue, one candidate, that don't have major expenditures, but yet staff spend quite a few hours trying to assist them because they are all novices and they require a lot of attention.
Thank you.
All right. Any further questions? Representative Bakadak.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to get a broad understanding of this. You know, my borough, the North Slope Borough, we're under 15,000 residents, and when I ran for assembly, I had to file a POFD, didn't have a problem with it. Don't experience the turnover with our clerk or any of those issues. So I wanted to just clarify that, and I was trying to find the language in the bill, that if a municipality technically falls under the exemption number, that they could still self-elect to require their assembly folks to file POFDs, et cetera. And then in the sponsor statement, my second question, there's already a minimum population exemption for campaign disclosures. Can you provide us what that, are we mirroring that number with that 15,000 mark, or is that a different number? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Through the chair, Representative Pat Kotak, could you repeat the second question about that?
So in the second or third paragraph of the sponsor statement, it says in the second sentence, there's a minimum population exemption for campaign disclosures, but none for POFD filing. I understand that the POFD filing is what this bill is going to address, but what is the population exemption for campaign disclosures already? Is that, are you guys mirroring that number?
Through the chair, Representative Pat Kotak, I believe so. I would, again, lean on Heather Hepton to answer this. For the, I think the, your first question as well, if she could.
I believe. Through the chair, Representative Pat Kotak, as I understand it, you were asking, your first question anyways, asked if exempted out of POFD under the Alaska Public Offices Commission, whether these municipalities could elect to manage it themselves and require that their officials file POFDs or something similar. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
And yes, the answer is yes. And in fact, I know that a few municipalities do already do that. Municipalities that have opted out of POFD under APOC statutes, but they do make their public officials file something similar. As to your second question regarding the campaign disclosure threshold, that particular threshold is 1,000 as far as the population. So communities of less than 1,000 are not subject to campaign disclosure law.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess in your answering of my first questions, as far as kind of exercising the self-option to have your assembly folk or municipality office holders follow a POFD filing, would that, with the way the bill's written right now and the responsibility of your office, would that still be able to be something that can be accomplished online? Because when I was an assembly member, it was, you know, log into myalaska.gov and do the filing and click send and submit. And it was easier than trying to find a printer and print it out and bring it to the municipal clerk. Is that something that still can be accomplished with the way the bill's written as far as online filing if we do self-elect and we fall under that 15,000 population threshold?
Through the chair, Representative Pakatek, as it's written right now, I don't believe so. Filing for these communities that would be exempted under our statute, they could certainly build their own system, but as far as, I mean, let me backtrack now that I think, I don't know, I guess, the answer to that. I would have to think about that a little bit. I mean, there's, anybody can file under our system. And if they chose to use our system, that it could create problems. I need to think about that one a little bit more.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's, you know, part of this process here is figuring out these little situations that could potentially slip through the cracks. And I would say just from the attitude from my assembly, we're such a small community. We have so many powers and authorities as the municipality. There's a lot of money going around, and it's helpful for us to be able to have a properly campaigned, you know, a disclosure with all of the interests when you're a part of every Native organization up there just by birth. You don't get an opportunity to disinterest yourself. It's helpful for us to be able to, in the small communities, disclose everything properly. And then when it comes time to having to exercise our authority as assembly folks or city council members, you know, have that disclosure and either opt out or opt into the vote or whatever. So I appreciate that, and I look forward to the follow-up on that, Madam Chair.
Are there more questions from the committee to send the maker and Ms. Hebden away with? Okay, I'm seeing none. So we're going to set this bill aside and take it up at a later date. So we'll hear again and have answers, and we're going to take a brief at ease and transition. Coming back on the record, and Representative Prox has joined us at 8:30, and we're going to bring back up Representative Schrage on House Bill 227 related to municipal energy and resiliency. Are there any opening remarks you want to make? We do have a number of amendments that members have offered, and there should be a packet of those amendments on your desk.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. Yeah, just very briefly, I'm looking forward to the discussion today as we work through amendments. You know, I'd just like to remind committee members that, you know, this has really turned out to be a grand new financing mechanism that we've seen spread throughout the United States. And while we did put a bill in place and allow for this commercially or property assessed financing mechanism here a few years ago with HB 80, this bill expands that program, loosens some of the restrictions on what kind of projects can be funded using this funding mechanism, and should help to spur development and investment in our communities throughout our state. As discussed during the last committee meeting, there are quite a few communities with taxing authority that would be able to benefit from this bill. So looking forward to the discussion. I know there's some questions around what exactly fits into resiliency, and we'll just deal with that when those amendments come up. So looking forward to it. Thank you.
All right. We do have, like I said, six amendments were submitted. Representative McCarty, one of yours is labeled amendment number one. Did you?
I move amendment number one.
And I'm going to object for purposes of discussion. Now, there is my understanding is there's a legal memo that goes with amendment number one. Do you want the, and?
Yes, if I could copy that memo, I read that definitely, but I don't have a copy of that.
Okay. I'll have my staff, we'll take a brief at ease. Record, we've distributed the legal memo that is attached to Amendment 1. Representative McCarty, did Did you want to speak to your?
Yes, thank you. So the discussion of 227, that it's been, at least what I'm hearing, about commercial buildings and for the energy efficiency and resiliency of commercial buildings. So the amendment is to put those words into the title of the bill. The legal comment was that by putting that in there, it would restrict or eliminate some of the language of 227 because it doesn't apply to commercial buildings. And that's exactly the intent of the amendment. It's just to define it to what I understand the bill is about. Thank you.
Representative Shragi.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. And so I appreciate the intent of this amendment. However, as the legal services memo states, there are provisions of the bill that apply to other projects than just commercial buildings. And just for committee members' understanding, the title of the bill is just for the purposes of moving the bill through the legislature so that all of us have a proper understanding at first glance of what the bill encompasses. Changing the title won't actually change the substance of the bill. Rather, it would make the title inconsistent with the contents of the bill and therefore constitutionally invalid, as I understand it. So you know, if we would like to amend the bill to make it more specific to commercial buildings, I think that the proper way to do that would be to amend the corresponding sections of the bill that would need those changes, not to amend the title of the bill. Functionally, I just don't think this matches what the intent of the amendment is. With all due respect, and so I oppose the amendment.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So, you know, maybe it's me, but I just assumed when I read this bill that it only applied to commercial buildings. And you're right, it doesn't say that. So I could have a shed in Muldoon somewhere that's worth $10,000, and under this bill I could put $5 million worth of EV charging stations into it and become a business. Charging cars or a little coffee shop and do the same thing or my own personal home. I mean, this is too wide open for me. I think it needs to be commercial buildings. I tend to agree with Rep. Shragi. If we're going to change it, we need to change the whole thing. But I do agree with you as well that it should be commercial buildings. You know, why are we giving... was this intended to give everybody a shot at resiliency? And holy cow, I'm all over that.
I'd like to actually turn things over to my aide, Ryan Johnston, for just a quick clarifying remark, because I think there's a little bit of misunderstanding here, and it's not as wide open as may be perceived.
For the record, Ryan Johnston, staff's representative, Shragi. So under AS 2955-100A, it expressly says existing privately owned and commercial and industrial property. So the programs can only apply to commercial and industrial property. And so this can't be used for anything. This has to fall within those bounds of commercial and industrial property.
Follow up. So then this amendment would actually more conform the bill to fit the statute.
Representative Shragi.
Yes, Co-Chair Hannon, Representative McCabe. I don't believe so. I think that the issue is that the amendment specifically deals with sections that also apply to other statutes. But however, this CPACE program is limited. There's a reason it's called CPACE, Commercial Property Assessed Clean Energy is what it was called. And we're talking more of the first three letters there, but again, it's restricted just to those commercial and industrial properties. That's my understanding. That we could maybe turn to legal services, but that's my understanding.
Representative Drummond, I had you next, and then Representative
Pacheco. Thank you, Madam Chair. So a commercial property could include apartments. For example, it could be an apartment building for rental. But it couldn't be a condominium project, say one large building of multiple separately owned units. It would have to be a commercial property, say 36 apartments, maybe upstairs from retail or office space, mixed use development. But the apartments would not be individually owned. They would be rented by the building's owner and therefore qualify as a commercial property.
Representative Drummond, through the co-chair, I believe that's correct, that it would be restricted in that way. Yes.
Follow-up?
So is there a program that would apply to potentially condominium projects that are similar in structure to a mixed-use development, but the apartments are separately owned?
Representative Drummond, through the co-chair, I don't believe there is currently. I could be mistaken about that. That's kind of outside the scope of this bill. I do know that with respect to these property assessed financing structures, that just because they have been developed more recently within the last decade, that I think there's been a limited approach to introducing these into the way we do business. And so, you know, we've initially restricted it to just those investments and ownership structures that we have the most confidence in. But we are seeing other states expand these programs broader than what we're doing today, expanding it to resiliency projects. In other states, they've got residential programs and others. So it's something that we could look to in the future.
Thank you.
Representative Pakatuk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Shrug, in the discussion from the Macacus here, no offense. Going over to page 3, looking at section 5 and the subsections A, 1, and 2, I think that's where you start to see the scope broadened beyond commercial and industrial property. And I think just for a matter of the way I understand the process, it would be that if we, for example, were to remove that subsection 2, then allow, you know, Ledge Legal to make conforming changes. That's how the title, I think, would change. But, you know, that's within our purview as a committee, obviously. So I think where you have that listing out in subsection 2 of all the different types of projects that can be outside of commercial or industrial property, that's where you have that broadened title, to my understanding. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Shrye.
Yes, Co-Chair Hannon. So thank you for those comments, Representative Pukatuk. I would like to note that on page 3, line 14, that this is to new construction or existing privately owned commercial or industrial property and that. So then subsections 1 and 2 are still limited to just those commercial or industrial properties that are privately owned. So, you know, I think there is quite a bit of attention on this subsection too, but that subsection does not actually expand this beyond commercial or industrial properties. It does expand the types of projects that would qualify for this financing mechanism, but again, those projects have to be for a commercial or industrial property.
Follow up.
Thank you, Representative Shrug. And I'm, you know, just reading through the last sentence of the Ledge Legal memo, where it says the scope of 2955-100A is not clearly limited to commercial buildings. And so I can see kind of the confusion there, but, you know,
Could I interject, and are we building versus property? Is that the nexus of the difference? So you might want to do your commercial property includes a building, but it also includes some land around it, and you want to do erosion and earthquake on the property, but it's not the building. And so the amendment would propose to limit it to strictly the buildings, not the entire property. Is that the goal?
Through the chair, that's correct. So it's talking about buildings.
So you
throughout there.
Okay. Representative Shrugge.
I'd like to turn that to my aide, Ryan Johnston.
Ryan Johnston, staff representative Shrugge. So the amendment number 1 deals, again, like Representative Shrugge said, with the title. So the issue would be is that the underlying bill is for commercial and industrial property. So by changing the title in the way that amendment number 1 would then in effect nullify the industrial side of the bill and would make conflicting sections within the bill. So and on another note, this bill relies on, Representative McCarty made a point about just wanting to be on buildings. Well, new construction, would in thought or in theory be on a piece of land that was zoned for commercial use, industrial use. So that would also conflict with the intent of the bill to allow new construction to be utilizing CPACE programs.
Because it's not yet a building.
Correct.
Representative McCabe. Or, excuse me, Representative Prox, I had you next.
My question was answered
okay.
Up till this point. Yeah.
Representative McCabe.
I still see this as an issue. It needs to be focused on buildings, whether new construction covers the buildings. If you're going to construct a new building, this would apply because it's in here. It says construction of new buildings. What I have a problem with is construction, and it goes right, I'm sorry, but it goes to the green agenda. I could have a industrial or a commercially zoned piece of property on the corner of 20th and Muldoon, and I could put in a charging farm with nothing but charging stations under this bill, get a huge tax financing break, and make a pile of money on the commuters that are leaving Anchorage that forgot to charge their cars on the way out. I don't think that's the intent of the bill. I think the intent of the bill is to provide resiliency after or for earthquakes or for floods or for high winds so that our commercial buildings can continue to operate quickly after some sort of event. Resiliency, despite how some are trying to spin it, resiliency is very tightly defined. So if we're going to say we're doing this for building resiliency, then it needs to be for building resiliency. You don't need to have resiliency for a piece of property because it's a piece of property. How would you fix that? So,
Coach Hannon, if I might address the comments from Representative McCabe, I think I want to make three points here because I think you bring up some valid concerns, but I want to be really clear about what the bill does and how this might actually work in application. So, first, with respect to whether or not it needs to be a building specifically, you know, again, I brought up in the last committee meeting the example of Raven's Roost co-housing in my district, where they bought a large piece of land, they put in a bunch of co-housing units, and they could interconnect those, be able to hook up a generator or maybe an electric vehicle to that grid, and be able to weather a cold storm, a blizzard, a transmission line goes down, et cetera. They could also, as is already in law, use the CPACE financing to put in solar panels, for example. Not on the building. Maybe it's over the parking lot or in a little field behind the buildings. That wouldn't be on the building, but it would be interconnected with this type of resiliency project that we're looking at. The second point I'd like to make is that this isn't a financial break. This is just a new financing mechanism that allows them to place the obligation on the property instead of the individual owner. And so it allows them to establish a more secure line of credit that has a longer term and therefore a lower interest rate. But if you were to look at the fair market value of that compared to other loans, it's not a financial break. There's no subsidy from the government. We're just utilizing the municipal taxing authority to create a new financing mechanism where, again, it's assessed to the property, not to the actual individual business owner. There's no break. Lastly, I'd just like to note that whether you think that this should be limited to commercial buildings or not, this amendment, with all due respect, does not limit the bill in any way whatsoever. It's just a description of what's in the bill. The title just needs to conform to what's in the bill. If we want to make changes to the bill itself, I think there's a way to do that, but this amendment is not that. Thank you.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can see a lot of places where stormwater management, for example, would be smart to manage for the building that you own on that property. And also, as regards the neighbors of that property, there's a commercial property in my neighborhood that under previous owners and being paved from edge to edge used to shed all of its rainwater into the neighborhood streets. And it was a freaking mess. But the new owner of that building had to create a drainage structure on the so that all of the drainage was taken care of on the property instead of flowing off the property onto public streets and into neighbors' properties. And that's a pretty typical requirement. But I think if you didn't take care of stormwater on your own property, you would risk damaging your own building if you didn't take care of that. So I don't see why it should be only limited to the building. itself.
All right. Are we ready to vote on Amendment 1, or are there more questions or concerns? All right. I'm not seeing any. Ms. Rowland, we are voting on Amendment 1. Can you call the roll, please?
Representative Drummond.
No.
Representative Hoxcox.
No.
Representative Crock.
No.
Representative Picardi.
Yes.
Representative McCabe.
Yes.
Co-Chair Froggy.
No.
Co-Chair Hannon.
No.
Two yeas, five nays.
So with two yeas and five nays, Amendment 1 has failed. That brings us to Amendment 2.
Madam Chair, I move Amendment 2.
I'm going to object. Representative Drummond, do you want to speak to your objection or have Representative McCarty speak to his amendment?
I think I would like to hear what Representative McCarty's intent is with this amendment.
Okay. Representative McCarty.
So in Amendment 2 is that Section 12 is stating that this is going to be retroactive upon the decision for if it's voted for. That means all projects that have to had financing before is going to be resubmitting, you know, for the financing of now. And I believe that in order to get financing, you had to do some type of business plan model that putting together those different things. And I don't see a need for something that's going to make things retroactive, because that also brings up concerns of precedent setting for retroactive of many other things.
Representative Schrage.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. Representative McCarty. So, you know, I look at this similar to refinancing a mortgage. Maybe interest rates are lower, or a better, bigger bank comes to town and is able to offer a better package, or able to qualify now for a longer term. Some condition has changed that makes it beneficial to me to refinance. I think what this does is recognize that we are introducing a financing mechanism that is of great benefit to commercial property owners and industrial property owners, to be clear. And there may be those who have already taken on mortgage business loans or otherwise taken on debt to finance construction, where this new financing mechanism, which again has been very well vetted in the lower 48, they may want to take advantage of that now that they have a project that qualifies. And so they could essentially refinance their mortgage, but instead of exchanging a mortgage for a mortgage, they would exchange a mortgage for a property lien. And I think it just allows our commercial property owners to take advantage of a better financing mechanism, which then may free up capital for them to then further invest in their community, whether it's Anchorage or Wasilla or Juneau, should they establish a program or otherwise. I think it just is a great way to, again, take advantage of a better financing mechanism, which then allows them to make further investments in our community and develop our community.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So under this, those people who may have done a program or rebuilt or done their own resiliency, or maybe not done resiliency, they had to remodel their business and they didn't do any resiliency projects because we didn't have this in place. We didn't have this funding credit mechanism in place. They'll be further disadvantaged, but they get nothing essentially from this because they didn't do any resiliency projects because they couldn't afford them.
Representative Shragi.
So I'm not sure that I'm fully understanding your points there, but I do think that this recognizes that if someone has made those improvements, I think back to Representative Drummond's example a few moments ago where a commercial property owner, maybe of an apartment building, you know, if they're seeing increased water or maybe they have drainage issues that are pre-existing, they've gone and done the right thing to improve their property and better channel that stormwater, make those facility improvements. Well, now if this bill were to pass, they could then rather than take on that debt themselves for improving the entire property and the stormwater management on that property, they could attach that lien to the property where I think it actually better fits. If you're making a long-term investment to better manage the water and resiliency of that property, why not have that associated with the property and whoever may purchase that building later on and thus the property as well? I think it recognizes that that's a good decision to make, and you should be able to utilize – you shouldn't miss out just because you made those improvements 2 years ago rather than in another 6 months should this bill pass.
Representative McCabe, follow up.
Thank you, Coach Johannan. And so why just 2 years? Why not 5 or 10 or, why not go back all the way to 1964?
Coach Johannan, if I may respond. Frankly, I would support an amendment extending, a conceptual amendment extending that period. I just would prefer not to see it go away because I think, again, if someone has made these improvements, let's recognize that they've made those improvements to their property and may enable them to take advantage of a better financing mechanism. If you would like to conceptually amend the 5 or 10 years, I would fully support that.
Thanks.
Representative McCarty.
Thank you. Through the chair, so the question ties with this. You brought up a statement. Someone does this improvement in the prior 2 years. They get one of these loans, and then they flip the property and put the debt on the new owners. So, because that's my understanding of the pace. And one of the comments from the testifiers was that it helps for the construction of energy and resiliency, but it was very clear that said it also avails funding for business owners to use the money for other purposes, and that is a red flag for me.
Coach Johannan, if I might respond, I think it's a little bit of a nuanced issue, and I take your concerns to heart. I think that they're not warranted, however, when we think about how this functions. So let's try to break this down. So, if I were to use conventional financing mechanisms and I took on a loan, I then sold that property for, let's say I took on a loan for $50,000 and I then sold the property for $100,000. I would pay off my debt and my profit as an owner, or the net would be $50,000 that goes back into my pocket, $50,000 that pays off my loan. If I used the property assessed mechanism, where it's a lien on the property, when I then went to sell that property, instead of selling it for $100,000, I would sell it for $50,000 because the buyer would recognize that it's not worth $100,000. This property is encumbered by $50,000. And so is that clear the way I've explained it? All of this is going to be disclosed in the purchase process. Any potential buyer will recognize that there is an assessment on that property, and that will then reduce the value of the property in the buyer's eyes, therefore providing the seller less capital, the same amount of capital in either case. To address the I think, part that you're taking concern with, where it provides more funds to the property owner, I think that's what you were concerned with as the red flag. What we're talking about is, if I get a conventional loan at, say, for $100,000 and 8% interest rate, the value of that loan is going to be higher than if I were to get that same $100,000 loan at a 6% interest rate. And so that's what we're talking about, is because it's assessed to the property, the banks have a higher degree of faith that it will be repaid, therefore have less risk, and are therefore willing to offer a lower interest rate. And so it therefore frees up some capital on the margin, a small amount typically, or a large amount if we're talking about a very large investment, but proportionally a very small amount, but again, a material amount that could be used to then again further invest in the property, further invest in their community and other developments or otherwise. But again, all of this, as we went over in the previous committee, is going to be vetted by the financial institutions when these transactions are proposed. I hope that addresses your concerns.
Slightly, and I don't want to get off of the amendment. Actually raises more concerns, because I think when you go for a loan, you're saying the loan is for this purpose only, and the lender's going to say, well, we're going to give you some extra money because you go bet on the ponies. You know, and if you're going to use money for other purposes, it's not designed for the purpose of the building or the property of such, that's the concern. But getting back to the amendment here is just that the piece of, as a business owner, you know, I want to be able to grow my business, but that piece of someone lending is to know that that's going to be used, and there's a risk taking in that lending of that. I know for this program that we have reduced the risk to the lender because the property is seized. So that's just an interesting dynamic there. Instead of when the sale of property and all of a sudden the liens are taken care of at the point of. So here with this retroactive, it's we have a bunch of properties that have been already gone through the vetting of the loan, mm-hmm. and now we're going to come in and allow them to be, seize money, which I'm very concerned if it goes back to 1964. Thank you.
Coach Johannan, if I might address those comments. So, you know, with respect to using the money for something other than was intended, I think it's important to remember that only, so if I took out a conventional loan to do improvements to my property, only those improvements which fit the definitions within the bill would be able to be refinanced through the commercially assessed property mechanism. And so the money would still, frankly, if we're talking about refinancing, very likely the money has already been invested in those projects. And when you then went to repackage this as a property lien, the lender and the municipality would make sure that we're refinancing the monies associated with those resiliency or clean energy project improvements. So lastly, I'll just note that, you know, I think looking at the letters of support, we see both commercial property owners and lenders supporting this. I think it's a good way for us to, again, make more secure loans on a longer term, at a lower cost of capital for the property owner, and allows them to further invest in their communities. So I think that support speaks volumes, and would just point members to that. Thank you.
Representative Fakata.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this question is tied to the underlying bill. Sorry, I missed the first rundown of 227. So what we have is a look back at 2 years for benefit to your refinancing, as you've established. And I want to know what kind of tax payment implications there are for the total underlying bill, and would it make sense to have that? So, for example, if a municipality taxed you based on a higher assessed rate because of whatever, you know, improvements you made, would it make sense if you're going to be able to take advantage of the investment that was made 2 years ago, if there's also the tax penalty, a higher tax penalty, and this is obviously you got to answer that first because I don't know. Would then you still, you know, if you look back for your 2 years for the benefit, would then there still be a appeal process, I don't know, through the municipality and taxing to have them have you pay a higher rate or more money on an assessed value?
Through the co-chair, Representative Puckatuck. So if you had made the investment to your property, you very likely would have a higher assessed value and therefore be paying higher property taxes. And that's going to be true whether you use the property assessed financing mechanism or you pay cash out of pocket or you have a conventional loan. You make the improvements to your property, it's got a higher value, you're very likely to be assessed a higher property tax as a result. With respect to this financing mechanism, if you were to refinance, it would simply add an additional amount to your property taxes because, again, we're using that municipal taxing authority as the conduit for those funds. Your property taxes would be then increased further, and those property taxes would then be remitted to the financial institution, as I understand it. So I hope that clarifies the question. I believe this is all above board, and anyone making this sort of investment would be very aware of those tax implications.
Seeing no hands leads me to believe we're ready to vote on Amendment 2.
I maintain my objection.
You maintain your objection, so we're going to vote. Ms. Rowland, can you please call the roll?
Representative McCabe.
Pass.
No.
Representative Potstar.
Yes.
Representative Prock.
He's left the room.
Not present. Representative McCarty.
Yes.
Co-chair Froggy.
No.
Representative McCabe.
Yes.
Co-chair Hannon.
No.
Three yeas, three nays.
And with three yeas and three nays, the motion has failed. Representative McCarty, Amendment 3 is yours.
Okay, I move Amendment 3.
I'm going to object. There is also a legal memo that goes with Amendment 3, so we'll get that distributed and take a brief at ease to give members the opportunity to look at that. Everyone's had a chance to look at the legal memo. Representative McCarty, do you want to speak to your amendment?
Thank you. Through the chair. So this is, again, the issue of defining the type of construction being done on the properties to be a commercial building, as we had in Amendment 1, which is deferring to commercial buildings, and stated in the discussion about that, that if it's listed in the bill, and there it is here in Amendment 3, it's listed in the bill to refer to commercial buildings.
Representative Schrage.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon, to the committee. So with respect to this amendment, one, I would again note that the bill underlying statutes as well as this bill are already restricted to commercial and industrial properties, and that as the legal memo states, this would be somewhat inconsistent in that it doesn't reference industrial buildings. Second, I would note that, again, some of these improvements can be made to the property itself, both in the existing statute and through this bill. And so limiting it to just buildings could be somewhat problematic. And third, I would just note that this section is on the reports that are required, not the actual types of investments or developments that qualify under this bill for this financing. And so it seems somewhat inconsistent that we would allow a wider scope for the types of developments allowed or investments allowed, but then restrict the reporting to just those investments on commercial buildings, but not industrial buildings or commercial or industrial properties. Thank you.
Further discussion? All right. So I think we're ready for a vote on Amendment 3. Ms. Rowland, please call the roll. And I will note Representative Prox has left the meeting. He did say he needed to leave. So go ahead on Amendment 3.
Yes.
Representative McCabe.
Yes.
Representative Brown.
No.
No.
Representative Prox not present. Co-chair Froggy.
No.
Co-chair Hannon.
No.
Two yeas, four nay.
So with a vote of two yeas and four nays, Amendment 3 has failed. That brings us to Amendment 4. Representative McCarty.
I move Amendment 4.
Object.
There's been an objection. Go ahead. You want to speak to your motion? I think she wants to hear about
your
motion.
Okay, yes.
Your
amendment. Thank you. Okay, the Amendment 4, that what is being deleted is the involvement of an energy auditor in the process there. And one of the things that came up in the discussion of the presentations was to have people that are auditing the validity of these projects. And I'm not sure why this is being deleted when we want to have a third party involved in verifying rather than just freely, you know, moving projects.
Representative Schrage.
Yes, Co-Chair Hannon. So the reason that I believe that we're seeing the requirement for an independent third-party qualified energy auditor to be required, the reason we're seeing that removed is because we're adding projects to the scope of this financing mechanism that don't have anything, frankly, to do in some cases with energy. For example, seismic or stormwater improvements, it doesn't make sense that we would require an energy auditor for that purpose. The second point I would note is that, again, you know, I don't know of any bank or, frankly, anyone that, at all that would loan me money without vetting the project or the investment that I'm proposing. And I know that specifically with financial institutions who are the qualifying entities that would be in the position to provide these loans, I can't think of any bank or other financial provider that would not require an assessment that is of a substantial rigor to merit them or give them confidence that lending that money is in their best interest. So, you know, I think the banks are already very rigorous in their vetting of projects, and I leave it up to those financial institutions and private entities to determine which investments are worth investing in. Thank you.
Mr. Representative Schrage, my read of it also was that the bill is expanding from existing to new, and that you could only do an audit on a building that was existing. The auditor comes in and says, do X, Y, and Z, and then after you've done X, Y, and Z, you can verify that the energy improvements that were indicated and we're financing on have been met. But if you're doing new construction, you couldn't audit something that doesn't exist, but you could design it to be more energy efficient. So requiring an audit of it sort of is contrary to allowing new construction in addition. In the
end. Co-Chair Hannon, that is a great point, and you're absolutely correct. And the other thing I would note is just, again, I think we have to remember that, you know, while we do have a little more than a decade now of these programs existing, they were approached with a great degree of caution. And so when we first saw these property assessed financing mechanisms introduced, they were only introduced on projects where an energy auditor could come in and say that this investment will actually create a positive cash flow. It, you know, you're putting in LED lights, which is going to save you X number of dollars per year, which will then be enough to pay off, to pay your monthly or annual payments on your loan. The banks have now realized that these sorts of investments, frankly, they make good sense whether they create a positive cash flow or not. Managing your stormwater is very likely not going to create a positive cash flow. However, it may greatly improve the value of the property to the extent that they feel comfortable making that investment or providing that capital. And so I think what we've seen is a move away from ensuring that there's a positive cash flow, as so many other states have done, to now open this up to investments that, yes, create positive cash flow, but also ones that are just good financial sense for the property itself, but not necessarily the monthly cash flow. I hope that helps provide some additional clarity to committee members.
Representative McCabe.
I'd like to offer a conceptual amendment, if I can do that, to amendment number 4.
Go ahead.
I move that we insert the word, after the word auditor, we insert the words appraiser, comma, or licensed home inspector, comma.
Madam Chair.
Hold on a second.
Home inspector?
Auditor.
Okay, after the word auditor is where you wanted it.
Right.
Okay.
What were the...
So now we're going to questions. Representative Drummond and Representative Bogdan.
I'm objecting for the purposes of clarification. Did Representative McCabe say licensed home inspector?
Yes.
This is commercial property. that we're talking about, this bill is talking about. Is that not correct? So why would you want a home inspector? And I was thinking that there already exist construction estimators. There are companies that do nothing but construction estimating, and it seems to me that's what you want in a case like this. I don't know how an appraiser, I suppose an appraiser would do forward valuation of a property that isn't, of a project that isn't constructed yet, but a construction estimator would be the more relevant term to use rather than a home inspector, because this is in advance of, this is in advance of the project. So I object to this friendly amendment.
Yeah, that's fair, through the chair. Fair point. And I was just trying to expand the definition from energy auditor, and I'd be more than willing to even change that to architect or construction estimator. But I think there needs to be somebody. There's too much opportunity in this for nefarious activity, if you will, between banks and a good buddy commercial property owners. There needs to be a third party, I think. And you're probably right, an energy auditor is too restrictive, but maybe we can expand that so that it could be somebody, third party, giving it a quick look, saying, yep, he did all this. When I did it for my home, and that's where the home inspector came, I had an energy auditor that had to come in and look at the home. And then I had a home inspector afterwards that had to verify that I did the work I said I did. So I just think a third-party verification, however we do it, and perhaps home inspector is the wrong one, and I'm at a loss at this point mechanically how to undo the word home inspector, but an amendment to the amendment.
Well, why don't you withdraw your conceptual amendment?
Okay.
And then come up with a new.
Coach Hannon, if I might make a proposal, I mean, I do worry about legislating on the fly and, you know, how to get the right words in there. I mean, one, preferably, I'd like to see the amendment not move. If it were to move, and that's the will of the committee, I suppose one way that we might be able to do this just very broadly and ensure that there is some sort of check is to just strike energy, a qualified energy auditor from the verbiage there, so it would read from an independent third party. You know, I'm struggling, though, to put the right, you know, is home inspector correct? Is auditor correct? Is, you know, what is the proper language? And, you know, I'd be more than willing to work with you to come up with some language for that, for a possible floor amendment. But I do worry about legislating on the fly and trying to, I'm not an expert in home commercial property inspections or otherwise, so I worry about doing that.
We do have online three of the experts on it. We have Shana Kilcon, who was the energy and sustainability manager with the Solid Waste Municipality of Anchorage. We have Melanie Lucas Conwell with the Municipality of Anchorage, and we have Robert Pearson with the State and Federal Programs Manager, Division of Community and Regional Affairs. So I'm not sure, because two of those we heard from and they were familiar with CPACE expansion in other locations. So if Shana or Melanie, are you familiar with when states have gone from existing construction that required an energy auditor and expanded CPACE programs to new construction and other resiliency, how they've had the third party check on that?
This is Shana Kilcoin speaking with the Municipality of Anchorage. What we've seen in the lower 48, this actually is a tough one, because it's hard to tell depending on, for example, what resiliency project you're doing or what kind of new construction project you're doing. You will need to show that it increases the energy efficiency beyond kind of the base building code. And so you do need some sort of estimation based on that, but it's really difficult to say, okay, you need this kind of engineer and an energy auditor, a qualified energy auditor, and that will fit all of these. And typically what statutes are doing is kind of leaving that up to the handbook, where we have all of the details about the program within it. And so they kind of leave that up to it. We'll still have, for example, for a renovation, we'll still have an energy audit needed. But depending on what kind of resiliency or broader project there is, that's going to change in how it's done and what is needed from the lender, for the property owner, and the municipality.
So, Madam Chair, at this point, I'd like to withdraw my conceptual amendment.
Okay. We don't have online today any of the people who spoke the other day that were, I was thinking that perhaps the lenders would have examples of the kinds of things they've required, you know.
So I have had some dialogue with one of the guys that was online the other day, KI, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. And I think what I'm going to do is discuss with him in preparation for a possible floor amendment. So, anyways. So.
Representative McCarty.
So this is of great concern. In fact, I just was at a meeting this week regarding energy in Southeast. And what came up in that meeting is not only just the buildings, but the anticipation that commercial buildings could have an energy excess that could feed into the grid. And this is kind of one of the big themes of the CPACE type thing. And what came up, which is interesting, is the grid would be tremendously overloaded. And so if some company is anticipating to build something and get revenue from that, and then find out that there is it's too great of a surplus exists, that, you know, this type of thing would be necessary in an audit to see if it's viable, not only for the building, that if it's energy efficiency of the building, but if it's anticipation of exceeding outside that. And already is a testimony of let's put in some solar panels and maybe we could use those to sell off as well as for the building. And that's where I think this is be important. However, because this seems to take energy of itself, that we need more information to make informed decisions, I'm going to withdraw this to find out more later on, to bring some amendment to it later on.
Okay. With Amendment 4 has been withdrawn. That brings us to Amendment 5. Representative McCabe.
Madam Co-Chair, I move Amendment 5.
Going to object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this does is change the language a little bit to tighten up the definition of what the amount of money that you can loan against, as we talked about the other day in this committee. I'm just concerned that somebody could design a project, sort of the silk purse, sow's ear kind of thing, or the lipstick on a pig kind of thing, and the whole value of the loan would rest on the project itself and not on the underlying structure or building, which may or may not be viable. And I get that the lenders are going to inspect it, and they're going to, however, I have seen this type of thing happen where all of the lending depended on the project itself, and then the project fails, whether it be the solar array fails, or the isn't viable, it doesn't work for reasons like Representative McCarty said, possibly the electrical portion isn't sustainable because somebody forgot to check with MEA or one of the electric companies or that sort of thing. So I'm a bit concerned that we are maybe allowing people to overreach with this language, and hence the amendment. Thanks.
Representative Schweige.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. And Representative McCabe, understand your concern and appreciate that. I can understand that. You know, I think, you know, again, as we look at what we hope to do here, I think it's extremely challenging and limits the application of these, the ability for property owners to utilize this financing mechanism if all we're utilizing is the pre-construction assessed value of those assets. I mean, anytime we look at a builder or someone starting their own business and going to a bank and seeking a loan, they have to put forward that business plan, that scope of work, demonstrate that they have a plan that they're going to create value for that that lender, that they're going to be good to pay those debts back. And, you know, I would just, you know, re-highlight from the prior committee and the public testimony that this legislation and the changes in this bill are modeled after the programs that we see in other states. And these lenders are supporting these changes because they've seen that they do not have a high risk of being gamed or a high risk of default, that these investments are working for them. And what they'd like to do is open up new markets to make these investments, to infuse our communities with capital, which is, I think, something that we'd all like to see. Now, we can all set for ourselves what we think is an acceptable level of risk. I'm relying on the experts, the lenders, the program participants that have provided testimony and relying on their experience that this works out well and is good for the community. Of course, that's going to be for each of us to make a judgment on.
Representative Drummond, then Representative Fakatak.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's smart to remove the word assessed, as I see the bill is proposing to do. I think market value makes sense because if it has a value, if somebody else wants to buy it and they want to buy it for a certain price, that's its value. And I don't think you can stop a transaction between private parties depending on somebody else's assessment of it. On the other hand, in Anchorage, if I remember from my assembly days, assessing commercial properties is way more difficult than assessing homes. There are thousands of homes. You can always find a comparable for a home to come up with an assessment. But commercial properties tend to be different and unique, and there aren't thousands of them to compare to, or even hundreds or even dozens in many cases. So it's much more difficult, and I remember the municipal assessor told me this, it's much more difficult to assess a commercial property as far as taxable valuation and all of that stuff. So I don't believe that the word market needs to be deleted from this bill. And also, we haven't talked about the second part of this amendment, which I don't agree with either. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Pakatak.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Inclined to support the amendment based on the intent of the maker. But as I read it, with what the bill already, as Representative Drummond mentioned, removing assessed, the amendment then would remove market. And the way I would read it, if this amendment were to pass, would be may not exceed 25% of the value of the property at the time of the program application. What would be the benchmark, I guess, of value?
I think the intent here was to leave the word assessed in there. So remove the word market, remove the change that inserts market instead of assessed. So we would leave assessed value in there. And maybe that didn't come out clear from Ledge Legal, but so there would be a value associated with an assessed value versus market value.
So, Madam,
go ahead and represent.
So, I guess just following up then, I think your amendment number 5 would, unless there's a following amendment that adds assessed back in there, unless I'm misunderstanding the amendment process here. But as I read it, the bill sponsor has stripped assessed out, and that's the bill that we're working on. He put market in. This amendment would remove market, leaving market nor assessed in the language. And so I don't know if it would be a conceptual amendment to amendment number 5 to under page 6, line 16, as your amendment reads, delete market. And then on that same
I guess discussion, reinsert or insert assess would be what the fix would be.
So, brief at ease.
Brief at ease.
So how do you want to do?
We're back on the record. So, Representative McCabe, I'm going to turn to you. We're having a discussion around Amendment 5 and specifically the deletion of the word market. And right now, as the amendment is constructed based on the bill, assessed has been taken out from the original. Do you want to speak to what you would like to do or your intent? And,
fair point. So the intent was to reinsert the word assessed, and we neglected somehow to get that done through Ledge Legal. So I could make a conceptual amendment to add the words reinsert assessed after the word market on line 2 of Amendment 5.
Okay, we're going to call that Conceptual Amendment 1 to Amendment 5, which would put assessed value back in after deleting market.
And I'm going to object based on what I said previously about assessed valuations of commercial properties.
Thanks. Right, and then we just, on the record, say that Representative Prox has rejoined us at 9:33. Representative Shragi, and then Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. So with respect to the conceptual amendment, if it were the will of the committee to yeah, we do need to fix the amendment and either leave market or assessed in the bill. The municipality of Anchorage would prefer market value, as I think is recognized, it takes precedence over the assessed value. It's the better metric to utilize for this. It's what the market is willing to pay for the property. That said, you know, again, I would just point to it's going to be a tremendous limitation on developers or those that want to invest in our communities by putting in a development if they're only able to utilize their existing assets and for that lien and the value that will be created by the loan has no consideration by the lender. I think that's a pretty burdensome restriction. But if we are to remove the ability to take in that future value that would be created, market would be the preferable base. Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair, my problem is with market value. And market value is just too nebulous of a term. It's not defined who sets the market value. Do we have a commercial real estate agent set the market value? I know five of them that will set the market value, whatever I want the market value to be set at. Not that they're doing anything wrong. It's just that they tend to play this game where, well, what's your loan going to be for? You know, there's some room in there for adjustment. And I'm not saying anything bad about commercial real estate agents, but there needs to be some sort of a licensed person, maybe market value as set by a licensed commercial property appraiser would be better, or something like that. But there needs to be a further definition or person that actually sets the market value. To me, just saying market value, I could figure out market value from looking in the newspaper and take that to the bank and say, here's five properties that are almost the same as mine. Yeah, they might be on the other side of town or whatever, but they're commercial properties, so I believe the market value of my property is X, and I don't think that's necessarily the way to go. So with that, I think I'll withdraw this and do it on the floor.
Okay.
And with all the discussion maybe included, we can come up with something a little bit more tight.
Okay. Representative Prox, did you want to speak?
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. I guess I will. I'm sorry I missed a bunch of this. I had another one in finance. But as I was thinking about that, the municipally assessed value is supposed to be the market value. Doesn't always work that way. They're behind as the market's rising. Sometimes they're too high as the market's falling. But it's supposed to be close. And that is the official determination on other property tax payments or assessment. And this is kind of attached to the tax. So it would seem like we should stick with what is legally in there. But I don't, it's worth thinking about because points well taken.
Quick point of clarification. Did Representative McCabe withdraw his conceptual amendment as well as the underlying amendment, or are we still on amendment number 5?
Yeah, that's a good point. So good I withdraw point. Both the conceptual amendment and amendment number 5.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you for clarifying, Representative Shragi. I took it to be both, but I was jumping to that end.
Okay. My fault.
Okay. That brings us to Amendment 6.
Madam Co-Chair, at this time, I'm not going to offer Amendment 6.
Okay.
Or let me rephrase that. I am not going to offer Amendment 6 at this time.
Okay. All right. Well, we've had a robust discussion here this morning. Is there other discussion on House Bill 227? Seeing none, I will entertain a motion to move this bill from committee. Representative Drummond.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 227, Work Order 32-LS1028/I, as amended, from committee with individual recommendations and attached 0 fiscal notes.
And I'm going to, we did not make any amendments, so could I have you restate that motion?
Absolutely. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 227, Work Order 32-LS1028/I, from committee with individual recommendations and attached 0 fiscal notes.
Seeing no objection, we'll just take a minute to sign the committee report. We'll take a brief at ease. We're back on the record. We are going to turn to Senate Bill 143 related to common interests, communities, and liens. We do have Senator Rivack's staff in the room for questions. We have Sarah Batten, counsel for Birch, Horton, Bittner, and Chirote online for questions. But we do have people signed up for public testimony, so that's what we're going to start with. So I'm going to open public testimony. There is no one in the room with us. I have four people signed up online to testify. So we're going to start with Anna Braley. Ms. Braley, if you will state your name and any affiliation for the record and give us your testimony.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. My name is Anna Braley, and I live in Anchorage, and I'm the board president of Edgewater Villa HOA, which is in West Anchorage. And so you have our letter of support for this bill that was sent when it was in a prior committee. But so I'm just going to briefly give some highlights from that letter, but I'll encourage you to read that as well. So Edgewater Villa is a small HOA located in West Anchorage. We were built in 1983 with 14 units in seven buildings. And we, so our HOA, we pay a property management firm each month to manage our books and support our annual meetings and deal with contractors. And the rest of the work is done by the volunteer board of the three of us who represent those 14 units. So I'm sharing this detail just to help folks understand that homeowner associations, especially small ones like ours, very much rely on the participation of all of our owners to function. You know, we're not a large organization. We all pay our dues to manage our shared costs. And we need people to serve on the board. We need people to show up and at our annual meetings and pay their assessments. So we rely on each other to really contribute to our shared responsibilities, which is the buildings, the structures, the land underneath, and then the money that we save for major repairs like roof replacements. So all of that to say, the financial impact of one major delinquency in one unit has a serious impact on all of us and can really, impact our savings. So the problem that SB 143 is seeking to fix is exactly the problem that happened to our association several years ago. So one owner had stopped paying their mortgage and their monthly assessment. Our HOA took steps to go through the collection process to get that assessment funding back or money that was owed. Our attorney advised us that we could foreclose, which we attempted to do for those funds. But because of the legal issue that this bill is seeking to fix, because we were incorporated before 1986 and our bylaws do not give us that first priority on the lien, we were unable to collect that unpaid assessment. So we also incurred legal fees, and basically our association, it cost us over $16,000 just trying to deal with this to get the money that we were owed for our assessments, which again go toward reserve replacement and all of that money that we need to maintain our units. So we were, this was several years ago before I was on the board personally. We were fortunate to have financially recovered, and luckily it didn't happen right before we needed to do something like a roof replacement. But it just really illustrates how, how especially for small associations like ours, it creates a huge issue. So we have actually talked about changing our bylaws, knowing that this was a risk and didn't, not wanting this to happen again. But the other issue in the bill that the bill attempts to fix illustrates the problem with trying to do that. And so, we were looking at potentially thousands of dollars and, again, hiring an attorney to help us and hoping that all of our lien holders, the banks, actually responded to allow us to do that, to even put us on the same footing as newer associations. So we were, willing to do that, but knowing that it would be difficult and that maybe not all of our owners would be willing to put in that cost to mitigate that risk. So in summary, again, our association strongly supports SB 143. We have been specifically harmed by this in the past, the issue that it's trying to fix, and we don't want to see that happen to another association or to us in the future. And so, again, we strongly encourage passing SB 143 and protecting homeowners against this financial risk. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question for you, Ms. Brawley. Aren't you the chair of the Turnagain Community Council?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, yes, I am.
Yes, I just wanted to thank you. I saw your name on the council's materials the other day, and I just want to thank you for your service to your community.
Thank you.
All right. Our next testifier is Deborah Brolini in Anchorage. If you'll put your name and any affiliation on the record, go ahead and give us your testimony.
Hi, my name is Deborah Brolini, and I'm testifying on behalf of myself. I'm testifying in opposition to SB 143. I was surprised to learn that the legislature is accepting a financial institution lobbyist approval, not actual financial institutions, where at a bare minimum should have invited testimony from Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, a state financial institution, and the property owner of several pre-1986 condominiums. Alaska Housing uses financial institutions as mortgage service providers like Wells Fargo, First National Bank Alaska, and et cetera. HFC also sued over a pre-1986 condo title of an Alaska Native woman's condo. HFC did take custody and title of her property. Homeowner ended up losing her home because she reached out to me too late. In regards to the notice, recently First National Bank contracted out my loan servicing to an out-of-state loan service provider where monthly documentation received went from 3 days to 15 to 18 days to receive monthly documentation. It took 15 days for me to receive escrow increase notice in January from Los Angeles. I would like to remind the committee the post office did notify the public in December that mail delivery would take longer. I am a former paralegal who worked for Tubman Clark and Ray as a paralegal. I foreclosed on homes from 1987 through 1990. Notification to homeowners is via certified mail, which does take longer through the U.S. Postal Service. Out-of-state mortgage service providers need to be taken into consideration in terms of notice. The legislature should be aware that condo association boards can go rogue, can have a lot of drama, and can have a lot of community politics, and have taken unlawful actions against homeowners in the past. I used to manage a Facebook page, Condo Association of Alaska, where I would hear condo association homeowner stories and help them navigate the process, even accompanying a homeowner to meet with a financial institution who deferred her mortgage service to the mortgage service provider who does not hold the note. The mortgage service provider paid the disputed condo dues. I was able to find the homeowner legal counsel where she was successful. The homeowner still has a lot of trauma due to the experience. In addition, the homeowner inherited a pre-1986 condo several years ago and is currently dealing with a large condo association community has a lot of drama and retaliation, in my opinion. It is not uncommon for board members, community members, to not understand financial records and federal and state laws. Condo associations fall under fair housing, and in my case, the condo association property manager and mortgage service provider violated my fair housing rights, and that is undisputed. The majority of homeowners who have reached out to me for assistance have been Alaska Native minorities and first-time homebuyers who do not have the money to hire lawyers, and Alaska Legal Services is overwhelmed and could take months for an intake. The hero in my story is Brian Butcher, CEO of Alaska Housing Corporation. Had I not reached out to him directly, I would have lost my home. Brian promised me that he would work with mortgage service providers so this doesn't happen again to another Alaskan. I think it's doubtful Brian Butcher is aware of this legislation. I do think the legislation needs work and needs House Judiciary Review to ensure the protection of homeowners, most especially homeowners who own their condo properties. Thank you.
Ms. Brolini, you provided us with some email testimony earlier that's much shorter than you've shared today. Could you share today's testimony with us in writing also?
Yes, I can.
Thank you so much. I'll make sure if you send it to myself or Representative Shragi again, and we will make sure it's distributed to the committee. Representative Fox, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. Will that email have her contact information? She raises a very good point that I was thinking about.
It does, and you should have in your supporting documents an email from her dated March 1st with her email on the top.
Okay.
It's been redacted.
Oh, it's been redacted? Okay, we'll make sure that.
Ask her permission.
Ms. Brolini, would it be, are you okay with us, with the office, the chair's office, sharing your personal email with the members of the committee or to communicate directly with a question?
Just with members of the committee.
Okay. Thank you. Our next testifier is Jason Hennings. So, Mr. Hennings, if you'll put yourself on the record and give your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Jason Henning. I am a property manager who's been working with HOAs on and off for a 10-year period in Anchorage, Alaska, and I want to speak in support of this bill and specifically address the part in regards to delinquency. So I've managed two different HOAs in Anchorage that were roughly the same size and same condition in Anchorage, and the difference between the two has always been the delinquency rate. One that was 1986 built has had a 5% delinquency. The one that was 1985 had a 24% delinquency. And the big difference is actually what was brought up in the previous call. When we're able to contact the bank, we're able to get 6 months of HOA dues paid on behalf of that individual so that they don't have to get a foreclosure hearing brought into it. Or we don't have to personally have a lawyer hired on an hourly rate going after an individual. We go directly to the bank and say, hey, they're behind, and they put it on the loan. And that prevents horror stories from happening, and no one in the HOA world wants to take a person home. What we want to do is work out a plan, and the best way to do that is by putting everything on a fair, even playing field, by making it so that post-1986 HOAs have the same rights as the ones that were that are free, and so that everybody's on the same playing field. I do, again, want to say that I believe this process will overall help HOAs in Alaska and make everything fairer. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next is Cindy Lentine, and again, Ms. Lentine, if you'll put your name on the record and any affiliation and give us your testimony.
Okay, my name is Cindy Lentine, and I am in Anchorage. I'm the president of Commodore Park Homeowners Association, and we were built in 1983. We are a 30-unit association made up of mostly blue-collar workers, nonprofit employees, teachers, and retired seniors on fixed income. Commodore Park has been denied super priority liens on multiple occasions when the owner has stopped paying their mortgage and monthly dues. Innocent paying owners must take the hit and eat the cost when this happens, while the bank gets the benefit of the HOA maintenance of their secured interest without contributing to the cost. Senate Bill 143 solves this problem and will clarify that pre-1986 properties are treated the same as post-1986 properties with regard to the lien. Commodore Park has wanted to amend its governing documents, but has been unable to because it cannot get responses from the banks in order to meet the lien holder approval in writing requirements. Senate Bill 143 solves this problem so our HOA can amend its declaration. I'm in support of Senate Bill 143, and I'm done with my testimony. Any questions?
I don't see any questions for you, Ms. Lentine. And I'm going to just clarify with Ms. Eames that there's no one else online to give testimony, and there's no one else in the room. Senator Rivak's office, I'm going to just ask, because Ms. Berlini's testimony brought up, do we have any communications from AHFC regarding the legislation? Have they issued support or opposition or raised any concerns, or is it something that we should reach out to get?
Representative Hannon, Emma Torkelson's staff to Senator Rebeck, no, we've not heard any concern or from them or any communication about this bill.
Okay. Right now, the intent is to take this bill up again on Tuesday, March 8th, and have a amendment deadline of Monday at 4 p.m. That's Monday, March 7th. Oh, I need to close public testimony. Excuse me. I need to close public testimony. I wandered off after I said there was no one else. So post-public testimony, we've asked Ms. Torkelson of Senator Rivak's office, and I think we'll send an email and ask AHFC formally to weigh in on the bill and hopefully get that communicated to us prior to the Tuesday meeting. but the intention would be that amendments are due on Monday at 4 p.m. to Representative Schrage's office. Representative McCarty.
You answered it. Thanks.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay. Seeing no one seeking my attention, and we have no further business to come before us today, our next House Community and Regional Affairs meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, March 8th, 8 a.m. in this room, Barnes 124. And with nothing else to come before us, we are adjourned at 10 a.m.